Put the kettle on. It's time for some F and T. Here's your host, Kirsten Gentle.
Welcome to FTNA's F&T Time, a podcast and video series aimed at keeping industry connected and updated. Welcome to the next instalment of F&T Time. This episode definitely resonates deeply with me as I'm a proud carbon warrior. And as everyone knows, the carbon warrior arm of FTMA is all about bringing awareness and important changes to Australia with legislated commitments for bio-based materials, significant investments in renewable resources, and implementing embodied carbon targets within construction. In what is an absolutely outstanding great step forward at the recent COP28 in Dubai, Australia made an agreement that stated, and I quote, "Recognising that wood from sustainably managed forests provide climate solutions within the construction sector, we commit to, by 2030, advancing policies and approaches that support a low-carbon construction and increase the use of wood from sustainably managed forests in the built environment. Such policies and approaches will result in reduced greenhouse gas emissions and an increase in stored carbon," end quote. I'm sure that's what we've been saying over and over for the last few years. Today's guest was present at COP28 and is one of the frontline warriors bringing global policy changes and procedures around sustainable forestry and ensuring timber is on the agenda for the built environment. With his background in journalism and many years of working with Australian government, he went on to be the CEO of the Australian Forest Products Association, and you may remember him from a podcast in season one. For over a decade, the amazing things he has done in that role began to change the face of the forest and wood products industry within Australia. AFPA, as an organisation, was young when our guest came in as the CEO, and in his time there, AFPA became an incredibly well-respected and important leader for the national forest and wood products industry. It has helped secure crucial recognition and commitments to forestry. Our speaker is truly passionate advocate, dedicated to getting the part forestry and timber plays in the fight against climate change acted upon, especially by all levels of government. His next calling in life has led him to take his mission globally. He is the Executive Director of the International Sustainable Forestry Coalition, a membership of the world's leading forestry companies working collectively to help solve some of the planet's greatest environmental challenges. The coalition is highly regarded and, in fact, was referenced at COP28 as a source of expert knowledge when it comes to setting a standard for biocircular economy. With his finger on the pulse of worldwide government climate action lobbying, our guest today is Ross Hampton. A massive congratulations to Ross and the work of the coalition being recognised at COP28. Please join me in welcoming Ross back to F&T Time. So Ross, thanks once again for joining us at F&T Time. This is your second time back. So just can you remind listeners how you got the passion for the environment?
Yeah, hello again, Kirsten. So nice to speak to you and also through you to all those folks in Australia. And I should say I'm having a cup of English breakfast tea on this grey, cold, pretty normal British winter morning. So perfect for F&T Time. The passion really, I suppose, is a bit like yourself, I imagine, Kirsten. It's seeing in the forest sector and the forest industry sector so much good that can take place for the world and for communities. I'm a bit of an environmentalist and I really believe, I love walking in nature, I love walking in the bush, or here it's not so much bush as woods, but I also understand what it means to support what we need to have in the world, sustainable fibre and timber housing and so on is really such a huge part of what we need to do to save the global environment that I don't see any choice or except to be passionate about the forestry sector, the forest industry sector. And I guess also there's the element for me coming from Tamworth and Nundle. You know, I really want to see people have meaningful, great jobs that are things they can be proud of, and forestry provides that as well.
Oh, 100%. Totally agree there, Ross. So, Ross, you've left AFPA, the Australian Forest Products Association. You've gone overseas. Can you tell me more about the International Sustainable Forestry Coalition? Like, how was it formed and how important is it on the world scale?
Yeah, I moved over here a bit over a year ago to sunny old London because essentially for a very practical reason, and that was because if you're trying to have something that's global, then you'll have people waking up in America and getting on calls at 5 and 6 a.m. and right through to Japan and Australia and New Zealand at 10 or 11 or midnight. So you have to be kind of in Europe to be in the middle of that world clock. So it could have been really anywhere. It could have been Geneva or France or, you know, UK. But it's sensible to come to the UK. And this is where I came to establish the world's first advocacy body, if you like, for forestry. So
I can't believe it didn't exist before.
Yeah, well, that was right. And that's what people kept saying when I said around the world, look, we have a void here we need to fill. They said, no, surely you've got something. Coal's got a world body, farmers got a world body, aluminium's got a world body, rockets have got a world body. There's just about everything you can name that's got an advocacy body working in the global conversations, not the national ones. But forestry just didn't have it. We were very disaggregated and dispersed, and there were good national efforts. And, you know, I think Australia really could be proud of our national efforts in the international arena. New Zealand stood up, Canada stood up, Finland stood up, but they were all individual efforts. What we needed was a collective voice, just like you do obviously in Australia with FTMA. And that is what we essentially set out to form. And big companies around the world, the idea of the body was to provide the chance for the CEOs of the big companies around the world to have a place at the table. And so far there's 13 of those world largest forestry companies that have come in, and that's given us 30 countries under the umbrella and about 12.5 million hectares that the group collectively Wow. looks after. Stewards, I like to say, because it covers everything from biodiversity to production tree planting. And that's across six continents. So in a few months, it's I think the reason it's got there so quickly is because it was such an obvious need, Kirsten.
And because I think you're having some great successes too.
Well, we are. And honestly, it's the doors that we're pushing on are unlocked. That's the great, I suppose, encouragement about where we find ourselves a few months in. We launched at New York Climate Week back in September last year. But when we asked to have meetings with those people who are kind of convening the big global conversations around biodiversity or climate or livelihoods, they welcome us with open arms because they haven't had a way to speak to a broad cross-section of the forestry sector before. And they, you know, at a world level, got a lot of smart people who are trying to solve world-size challenges, and they know that they can't do this essentially without us. What our companies bring to the table is the balance sheets, the scale, the opportunity to really move the dial. One of the things that I think resonates is when I say to them, it's all very well for you to be seeking funding out of the ESG portion or the philanthropy portion of people's budgets. These are very small portions, and that's great, and they're good. They're kind of donations towards environmental causes, and you know, let's have more of them. Good on them. But that doesn't change the needle. You know, the Sustainable Development Goals, which many people will be aware of, list a whole range of aspirations for the world. And at the moment, the UN FAO says that we would have to increase 100-fold the financing of those goals to get anywhere near them in the next 10 or 20 years. That's just not going to happen unless whole company balance sheets are in play. And that's not going to happen unless companies and boards can see outcomes, can see commercial outcomes. And so bringing those things to the table is really, I guess, why the successes are coming, Kirsten. It's because the global conversation is going, yep, we get that. Come on, come in the room, let's talk.
So FTMA News did a number of stories on the outcomes of COP28. Can you talk about the role that you had at COP28 and what the outcomes were?
There's two things that really take place at these COPs, the Conference of the Parties, as they're called, and there's three actually that we have to focus on. There's one on biodiversity, there's one on land degradation and desertification, and the big one that people know about is the climate one, and we've been there for the last two and we'll keep on going to those. And what happens in those places is there's a lot of people gather. There's sort of two rings inside the inside. The middle part is the governments of the world have their negotiators, and they're trying to work up a text, as it were, that all the countries will sign up to. And that's really important, and that can say negative or positive things about the role of agriculture and forestry and land use and other things in countries meeting their nationally determined contributions to climate change. So one part of being at COPs is to try to support really sound and science-based arguments in there. But second to that, outside that, there's another big ring of influence that's taking place, and a lot of global leaders and other world figures gather. John Kerry, for example, was there in the last one and talking about forests and climate and leaders.
I saw that on the TV, and I thought that was very impressive to have someone of such high stature speaking about it positively.
That's right. And the reason I mention that specifically is because that's not part of the official negotiations that are taking place, but the outcomes are enormously important. And as you would have seen what he was announcing at that, because he heads up a group that we've been working with called the Forest and Climate Leaders Partnership, which is a global intergovernmental group trying to deliver the outcomes of the Glasgow Declaration on deforestation. They announced a pivot or an area of work that would focus very much on green construction. And that green construction, of course, relies heavily, heavily on timber. And they were because of the conversations we've had with them, they said in the notes that went with John Kerry's announcement that we're going to need more planted and plantation forestry, and that means we're going to need more of what the groups like the International Sustainable Forestry Coalition stand for. So that's your answer about, COP really can deliver two things.
So you also, following you on LinkedIn, you see a lot of interesting things, and you talked about the president of COP15 desertification.
Yeah.
And he talks about a win-win approach. Can you explain that?
This is, again, I suppose, one of those examples of why it is working so effectively to bring global companies to these global tables. The presidents of the COPs, the three COPs I mentioned, are very, very important in the global conversation. And as I said, there's the climate, biodiversity, and there's also the third COP, which isn't so well known, which is about land degradation, avoiding land degradation and desertification, ultimately. And what I didn't realise, to be honest, and I think most people don't realise, is that COP understands that commercial tree planting is going to be a huge tool that they need to use in different parts of the world. But they mentioned South America, they mentioned Africa, they mentioned China, to slow down land degradation and create remediation and reforestation. And the president of that COP, Mr. Alain Richard Denwahi from Côte d'Ivoire, reached out to me, to our group, asked to have a meeting and said what he said, well, I think was quite profound, and I think was summarised why this global work is getting traction. He said, I know from my experience in Côte d'Ivoire that government can't possibly do everything we need to do. We have to partner with the private sector. We have to understand that private sector has to have a win for the balance sheet, and it also will then be able to give us a win on whatever our other mission might be. So in Côte d'Ivoire, he liked to talk about examples of offering perhaps 100,000 hectares as a concession to an enterprise and saying, look, I need this area reforested, in environmental plantings. Can you do something commercial with the other to make it work for you? Now, of course, as you and your listeners would know, Kirsten, who know a bit about forestry, the great thing for our sector is this is already what we do. Around the world, if you look at commercial forestry, almost everywhere, the companies are already setting aside riparian zones, they're creating buffers around old trees, they're creating animal corridors, and usually you'll find 10 or 15% of a land area is not planted commercially anyway, it's planted for other attributes. So it's not a huge philosophical shift for our companies to contemplate those sorts of partnerships that Mr. Donwahi was talking about.
What I like is that people are starting to see that forest growers and people that work in the forest industries, we are the environmentalists. For too long we've been demonised, and people now are starting to realise that we actually are part of that solution.
They are. And, I hear this a little bit that it's been kind of unfair that we haven't been treated well or we haven't been spoken of well. But, my answer to that has been a little bit of tough love for the sector, to be honest. I've said, and why do you think that is? We're not there. So how are people going to know what it is we can do if we're not there telling them? The default position, as you know, and it happens in Australia, it happens all around the world, particularly in the global north countries, is people want to keep every tree standing. That's kind of the starting point. It takes a fair bit of information, additional education and information for them to understand that actually cutting a tree down can be a good thing for the environment, not a bad thing. If, as you and I both know, Kirsten, if you add into that sustainable forest management, replanting, good use of the systems that go into the production and good management of the wildlife and so on. So, but that's a conversation, that's something that we have to be in the room talking about. There's a saying that we use quite a lot, which I'm sure you've heard, which is that if you're not sitting at the table, you're probably on the menu. and that's exactly what's been happening to us internationally.
No, definitely. So given Australia was one of the countries at COP28 committing to the policy advancements and approaches to support low carbon construction by 2030, in your opinion, what do you think it will mean for Australia? And are we finally catching up to the rest of the world?
I think it was fantastic that Australia was one of those 17 signatories to that John Kerry-led initiative about greening construction. I've got to be careful not to talk about national policy issues, of course, because, you know, we're international, we've got 30 countries, and inevitably I would stuff it up and get a nuance wrong in some country. But what I do say, if I ever get asked about national policies, is look at the big picture, Australia, please. I might be saying this to Canada, I might be saying it to the Nordic countries, any of the global north countries, look at the big picture. The big picture, which is why countries signed the Greening Construction Pledge that you mentioned, is that if we just take building, the current rate of building in concrete and steel will consume twice the world's carbon budget that's available for us to keep below 1.5 degrees. So if we keep going the way we're going in building, the 1.5 project is all over Red Rover. It's not even a chance of happening. So we have to pivot. We have to pivot to timber in construction. But on top of that, plastics are now like the world's fifth largest country, if you put it all together in the ocean. That's got to be dealt with. And that means pivoting to biomaterials. Textiles, everything we wear consumes about 10% of the world's carbon, or it creates about 10% of the world's greenhouse gases. That's pivoting rapidly to fibre-based rayons and so on. And then, you know, we're not even talking about the massive growth in pulp and paper, which is going on not necessarily in the same ways that we're used to in the global north countries, but places like India and China, massive increase, in tissues and everything we get in a modern lifestyle. And then, you know, layer on top of that sustainable aviation fuel. The likes of Qantas are wanting to go to, 90% sustainable aviation fuel in 10 years. All of this means that the pivot to the bioeconomy, the sustainable bioeconomy, which is absolutely foundational to getting everything else right, requires a lot more forestry. The World Bank thinks we need possibly four times as much timber and fiber in the system as we've got now by 2050. Well, where's that going to come from? So one of the things that I guess annoys me the most about some of the comments that are made about Australia from some who want to see less forestry is that we've got enough timber in Australia. Well, we do not.
Not
even for our own housing needs, and certainly not if you take a global view. After all, the same people who say that are likely to say that Australia should be contributing as a Western well-managed country, we should be contributing significantly to the global climate challenge. Yeah, fair enough, good on them. But you can't say that and then say, but we don't have to contribute to the global need for timber and fibre. Because what happens is, internationally, if countries of the global north reduce what they're doing in terms of forestry and forest timber supplies, is the demand will come from somewhere. It will go off into the Congo Basin, for example, in the middle of Africa, and that's already being denuded, deforested, at a rate of about 200,000 to 500,000 hectares a year. And that's not being replanted, whereas in Australia, obviously, everything is regrown and replanted that we use commercially. So that's the sort of global messaging that I think we have to all stop and think very carefully about in the countries like Australia.
Look, I just think you're doing a fantastic job, Ross. And when I saw, John Kerry stand up and it was talking, and then I saw that, the feedback from the people at AFPA that were over there, I just thought, wow, it's finally starting to make a difference. And so I wanted to bring you along to really say thank you to the International Sustainable Forestry Coalition. Thank you, Ross, for what the work you're doing and all your members are doing. And keep it up, because the only way we are going to get a greener future is if we use more timber, which stores carbon for life.
Thank you so much, Kirsten.
No worries. Thank you, Ross. Thanks for listening to another F&T Time. Bye.